Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. We are very excited because we have one of our most popular guests back today. We have Simon Lam of Purposeful Change. What we want to talk to him about today was what might sound like a slightly strange question, which is, when is work therapy? We sort of, over the course of all of these podcast episodes we've been recording, we've come to the realization that the boundaries between personal development, mental health, professional life, these are all blurring. And many organizations and leaders focus on helping people to understand the roots of their challenges, reframe limiting beliefs, and foster personal growth within the context of work that feels very much like some therapeutic processes that we might have conventionally found more in the kind of conventionally therapeutic world of psychology and things that we typically did outside of work. So, Simon, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you give us a quick intro to you again, just so everybody knows what you do and what you're up to?
I'm Simon. I'm the founder of a company called Purposeful Change, and we do purposeful change. So the thing that we try and do is help people be more resourceful in the face of complexity and ambiguity and challenge. And so what we're here to do is help people be resourceful and reframe some of the thoughts that they have in those moments of panic. You know, actually, my dad on his toilet wall, I remembered this the other day, had this thing called the desiderata. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Mm-mm. It starts with, go placidly amid the noise and haste, you know, whilst those around you lose their head, you know, and find what peace there may be in silence. And I think actually it really describes, I think my dad through the toilet wall inspired my work, because I teach people how to walk placidly amid the madness of the world and find, you know, a way of not being constrained, I think. And that's at an organizational level, community level, and individually.
Great. And so obviously already you're starting to talk about words that feel a little bit like therapy.
A little bit.
And so I think just to kick us off, how do you define the boundary between coaching, therapy, and leadership development? Where is that boundary? It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, well, of course it exists. It has to exist. I mean, the first thought I had as you were speaking was this idea that boundaries, all of them are false. They're invented, right? So there is no boundary between me and you in theory. If you think about air and the distance between us, we're connected. In fact, we're connected to everything in the universe. But human beings create boundaries. Some are helpful and some are less helpful. I think the boundary between what is therapy and what is therapeutic is a critical question for anyone to be asking if they're doing transformational work like I'm doing, like the kind of work that you're doing in the world, because those boundaries are there to safeguard human beings. Has the boundary shifted? Yes, I think it has. And you said it's blurring. I don't think actually there was ever a difference between my work self. I might have had a false difference between who I was at work and who I was at home. But I don't think you can hide who you really are when you're in the workplace, if that makes sense. I think you leak. And I think that's being discovered, and I think that's being uncovered. And it's certainly constantly my question in the work that I do is, what of you in that moment where you think you're hiding the core hidden part of you that's the home you? It's leaking out in the workplace, and I find that all the time.
But to go one step back, could we define coaching and therapy, the difference between the two?
Yeah. I think the way I start is, the question I'm always asking is this exploration in service of your leadership? And if the exploration is in service of your leadership in an organizational or life context that I'm working in, then it's a valid exploration. Mm. If this exploration is in service of your, just purely your healing, and you're, you know, feeling better about yourself in the world, that kind of, that healing process, then that's probably for a different context than the one that I'm often working in. Although I'm training to be a therapist, so, and I've also done training in therapeutic work.
Okay.
But I think one of the things we get muddled up with here is something feeling therapeutic in its process does not mean it is therapy.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. Mm. So the question I'm asking is this in service of leadership? And I guess the way I actually might look at it is like there's foundations of people. Therapy spends a lot of time like in the basement of your house, right? Sitting with the challenges and unpacking the boxes of your past and sitting a lot with just that. I'm looking at the first floor and the second floor and the third floor of the house you're trying to build. So my intention is all about who do you want to be and what do you want to create in the world, if that makes any sense.
So you said that you don't believe that things have shifted in terms of individuals seeing work as a more therapeutic environment, because as you said, you leak out whether or not you intend to. But do you think organizations are seeing a shift in terms of how much they're willing to go into some of those spaces of people's minds and experience that maybe they weren't before?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's for sure. Because I think what leaders in organizations have always wanted in my mind, and they still want, and I think this is still surprising to me, is they want results. So organizations are there to deliver outcomes. And then these leaders become the type of person they need to be in order to deliver those results by the snapshot time if it's a stock-owned organization. You know, it's like we got this quarterly snapshot we're building towards and I have to hit my numbers. So I become the person I need to be to hit those numbers. And therefore, you know, that drives the type of environment, this short-term, you know, kind of hard-driven, results-orientated environment that delivers the results. And that isn't sustainable. Mm. And what most leadership research over the last 50 years has uncovered is that isn't sustainable. That isn't what builds great organizations. That isn't what builds firms of endearment, just to quote, you know, two major bodies of research, or the Google Aristotle work that, you know, looked at what is it that drives high performance. And what I think organizations have done is look at the research that sits behind it and are now looking at psychology, because the inner game, you know, does drive the outer outcomes. Mm. The blind spot of most leaders is who they are, because that's they create the impact from the core of who they are. And I was working on that this morning with a leader. So, yeah.
Mm. Do you think that work ever provides a context where different breakthroughs are possible as opposed to therapy? Is actually looking at yourself in the context of work somehow helpful in some context, as opposed to looking at yourself in the context of healing?
Yeah, all the time. Hmm. I get healing outcomes. I read it yesterday, you know, a little note that was sent off the back of a program that I've run in the last couple of weeks. You know, this changed my life. I think that's the number one piece of feedback we get at Purposeful Change is the work we did in the last session or over the last year has literally shifted my perspective in the world. I've reframed how I see the world and how I see myself in it. And so the outcome was therapeutic and healed something, but that wasn't what we were working on.
Right.
We were working on them and creating a better outcome for in their role or in their organization. And through the process of exploring those boxes in the cellar, they unpicked things like, for example, my inner drive came from this was this morning. So in the coaching conversation this morning, what's your strength, my drive? You know, I put a whole load of energy into the system and we get stuff done. But when does that drive overplay? Oh, when I see people being lazy, I judge them and then I get critical, right? And where does that come from? Oh, and they stopped for a moment and kind of looked around. Well, I think my father used to say that, you know, don't be lazy, get out of bed. Mm. Don't be lazy, get on with your work. Don't be lazy. And so this phrase, don't be lazy, was part of this coachee's life in the early days of her life. And therefore she's going, oh my God, I'm living my father's pattern out now. And it's unhelpful when it plays into that space because I'm giving them fish or I'm pushing them and being directed with them at a time where I need to coach them and get them to understand why they're not working in the way that I want them to. Does that make any sense?
It does, yeah.
Total sense, yeah.
I think when you were just talking about how you frame coaching conversations in the context of leadership, right? So this is what we're focused on here. So anything else is not part of this situation, right? So we're not kind of therapizing a person. We're helping them become better leaders.
Yes.
But then is everything fair game in that context? So if you are trying to become a better leader and it does tap into some part of your life that maybe, I don't know, is there an inappropriate for work category that we sort of say, actually, we're not going to discuss that, even though it might be relevant to why you're not being a very good leader right now?
I think the first thing is the rules of the game are you're in choice. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we always talk about is the first thing is confidentiality of space. So whether this be an individual coaching or a group coaching environment that we're working in, you know, and or, you know, it's a whole organizational environment, we get people to start to say, well, you've got Vegas rules, right? What goes on in this session stays in this session. Mm-hmm. We take the stories out of it, but we don't take the people and the personalities. So confidentiality is the foundation of psychological safety. Then I think there's a second part, which is choice. So always be in choice about what you're bringing up and know the boundary between what is healthy discomfort and your panic zone, right? And so if you're stepping outside of your comfort zone, which is my job, I think, as a coach, is to help people step one or two, maybe three, maybe even four steps outside their comfort zone into that space, which I would call the learning zone, because we mostly learn things in discomfort, to then transport them back on the balcony into the comfort zone so they can look at that and go, what did I learn? What reframe of what I thought was true becomes now true? And that is part of a therapeutic process, right? Mm-hmm. Because you exposure therapy, we would take you, if you're scared of spiders, we would take you in front of spiders and see if they killed you. And if they didn't, we'd get you to look at that. But we're very careful about this zone called the panic zone. And I'm adept at seeing whether this thing's inappropriate to talk about. So when it comes back to what I would say real traumatic events, like maybe abuse or alcoholism or something else that's going on in their in addictions, then that's when I start to call the boundaries of saying, I think there's other things that, you know, might need to be in place here, or you might want to choose another path to follow. Or My most common practice is that I work in partnership with someone who has a therapist and me, and we both do our work. And I'm with senior leaders doing that all the time.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that people may be listening to this thinking, there is no way I'm going into a therapeutic conversation at work? Like, those two things just don't align. That may feel really alien to some, like boundary, potentially. Mm.
Yeah, and that's the point. It's not a therapy session.
Yes.
I think what I'm trying to say here is the outcomes may be therapeutic.
Yes.
But we're very clear that you have choice about what you want to discuss. Some clients I work with choose not to bring any of that.
Yeah.
And you work with what you can. Mm. There are times where you might advise someone to go, actually, you need to go to therapy first.
Mm.
Because until you unpack this, until you learn to work with it or to sit with this pain or fear that you're working with, you're not ready for the coaching.
Yes.
So I've often recommended and maybe fired clients in the past because, you know, it's not right now. And you have to do that very delicately and really compassionately.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also have to be in choice about who I'm working with and what I'm working with. Then the other problem is we've got clients who don't want to go to therapy.
Mm.
So there are quite a few senior leaders in the world that I've met over time who are in avoidance of the therapy world and then they want to use coaching as a pseudo-therapeutic process, if that makes sense.
Yes, total sense.
And that's another one where you have to hold a boundary.
Mm. So I think from my own experience, I've been in situations where I've been in some context at work where we've had some development as a group. And I have disclosed something about myself that I wouldn't have normally. Nothing earth-shattering, but something that is beyond what I would typically consider to be conversation for work. And more often than not, I have felt fine in the moment disclosing that and then have shame spiraled for the next 5 days, laying awake at night thinking, oh, God, I just gave too much. Like, I exposed too much. I was too vulnerable. You know, people are going to think I'm weak or whatever it is. And obviously that was not a psychologically safe environment because I probably wouldn't have felt that way afterwards. It's very easy to envision an environment where you're speaking to a therapist or a coach feeling completely at ease and very happy to disclose things because there's nothing at stake. It's obviously far more complex in a room full of people who you, yes, have said are going to be keep it confidential and have made all the assurances you're supposed to make and yet still not feel comfortable there. So what kind of environment or context needs to exist within that organization, within that culture, to make that feel like a place where those sorts of discoveries and breakthroughs and personal exploration are possible?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I think the first thing is the support system beyond the event itself. And so at Purposeful Change, we very, very rarely do a one-off event. We're doing an event as part of a process of learning. And what we're doing is, and we're doing a hybrid set of learning. So it's integrated with the event where there's large groups of people, then there's smaller breakouts of action, learning groups of smaller groups, and then there's one-on-one coaching. And that's when you can start to inquire on what's going on for you. And And the reason why I say that's important is because you just gave a perfect example that you got caught in your own mind loop. Mm. You were.
I'm often caught in my own mind loop.
Every day.
Me too. And that's part of the work that we're doing here, which is the perfect thing for you to have thought in that moment is exactly that. We call it the vulnerability hangover. Mm-hmm. And then for us to inspect what was actually going on in your mind afterwards. What were the thoughts that you were having? And are those thoughts true, false, or maybe? Mm-hmm. And if they're false or maybe, then to examine, well, what was really true in that moment? And what is it you can do? What agency do you have to find out whether that was really harmful? Mm-hmm. And what set of events or beliefs are you attaching your fear to? Because that was a fearful moment. Mm-hmm. And so to start to look back, and you're just giving me the perfect example of the, you know, without coaching you here or therapizing you here, is to say there must be something in your work life history that's indicated that that might be dangerous. Mm-hmm. Or you've been told that story repeatedly, or you've been bitten before. And then the question is what agency do you have to find out whether that was true or not? Mm-hmm. And are you willing to go in and ask that question to check and test? Which is why I think this idea of the big group sessions followed by, you know, individual coaching, which is so helpful and so useful in a work context, but also one of the reasons why I think sometimes we take mixed groups that are not from intact teams. Intact teams are really, really difficult to work with. That's why you have to be particularly delicate, because these people are working with each other day to day.
What do you mean by intact
team? So an intact team is like a, let's say we're a leadership team, mm-hmm. and we come into a session that, you know, one of my colleagues is running, and I declare something in front of you, and day to day I'm going to have to go back to work with you.
Right.
Actually, in many of the organisations we work with a group of people, 50 leaders that come in, none of them actually work together.
Right.
And so that's a different level of safety. Mm-hmm. And we've often found people are willing to say more vulnerable things to total strangers than they are to people.
There's less at stake, right?
Well, perceived. There's perceivably less at stake. That's my job as a consultant, right? As a coach, is to help people work out. I mean, you're giving me the food across the table. It's like, is there really something at stake here? That is the question. At some point, it was probably true there was. The question was, in that meeting, was there really? Mm-hmm. And am I going to allow myself to imagine that there was and get caught in that spiral, or that it was a really bad thing?
One of the things that you talked about on the last podcast with us, which has just really stuck with me, is this, the idea that psychological safety is something where we all feel completely comfortable all the time. Yes. And actually, the reality is, as you explained it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the reality is that actually psychological safety is being comfortable with the discomfort.
Yes,
right?
As well. It's both.
Yeah. And so how do you, because I think that's something that we're all bad at. And I say we're all, lots of people are really bad at, is sitting in discomfort, right? Especially in this world where we can, and I'm very guilty of this, by the way, we can stick a podcast in our ears all the time and basically never have to think about anything that's bothering us. So how do you encourage people to sit with that discomfort day to day?
Oh, wow, you brought up my favorite subject, because...
It's a great question.
Yeah, it is a great question, because it's all about human struggle. And I think, how do I help people on this planet realize that the struggle is part of the process, which is why I believe AI plus UI, I think I mentioned this before, universal intelligence plus artificial intelligence working together is what we need on the planet, because human beings want to soothe themselves with, you know, the avoidance of the struggle. You know, and so I'm writing a book at the moment. It was very tempting for me to get AI to help me, and I dumped it after working on one chapter with it, because it was too easy. And so how do I help? What we try to do is create experiences where people find that through the struggle, through the discomfort, comes breakthrough.
Yeah.
And that's part of the process. You go back to your previous statement before, breakthroughs don't come through easy, you know, just, you know, leaping in the meadows of the summer with Labradors and butterflies flying around, and, you know, and there's poppies in the field and it's all lovely and sunny. It comes through the grit and the challenge of life, which is why I try and help people not pursue happiness in life. I ask them potentially, or suggest, that pursuit of fulfillment is more helpful, because fulfillment can come in the darkest of moments.
But in a world of distraction that's so easily accessible now, we'll do it, we'll procrastinate, but the distraction away from the struggle, how do you then unravel all of that? Because we're all guilty of it. So I've done, I quite often remove Instagram, because I'm a millennial, that's my platform, right? Yeah. So I delete it, and I'm having a month off, because, and I'll sit there on the couch, and I'll, my hand will just go to grab the phone without even consciously doing it, right, for whatever it is that I'm going back for, because it releases dopamine, it's what it's there to do. So how do we unravel that when it's too easy to distract from the discomfort when it's actually the discomfort we need to address?
Yeah. I think I was saying in that moment, if I boil it down, is how do you first get people to realise and see that the struggle is of benefit?
Yes.
First thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, sits in the bucket of awareness. So I think awareness is critical. Awareness of my shadow, awareness of how distraction and is a quiet, comfortable thing, but actually it's a numbing.
Mm.
Listen, I gave up alcohol, in October last year. I've had a couple of drinks in between, and I've realised that it was numbing some of my ADD symptoms, which are awfully distracting and very painful for me to face into. But I'm not really me without them.
Mm.
And so learning to be present with the struggle of being me without distracting myself with either some alcohol or with a device or, you know, learning that the quiet numbing doesn't actually get me anywhere, doesn't bring me the sense of fulfillment, doesn't bring me joy. And finding and experiencing real joy is important. So that awareness of who I am, what my shadow side is and what my light is and what I use for distractions and when am I soothing myself and when am I in joy, that awareness of who I am. Then the second step is, what's my intention in the world?
Mm.
And that's what a purposeful change. We look at, say, well, why are you here? And often people will say to me, well, and this was a moment that ended up being therapeutic but wasn't therapy. A guy came up to me after a session and he said, as you speak it, Simon, I kind of realise that the universe has no point. And so if the universe has no point, then life may be pointless. And he said, and the problem is I've had thoughts that are pretty dark, horrible thoughts. And so I went straight into, look, you've got an employee assistance programme, and started helping him, thinking of areas he could get help from. And he said, but Simon, there's no point, because there's no point to life. And in that moment, I just said, well, if there's no point, what's the choice you have? What's the beauty of that? And he said, I could make up and invent my own purpose. It's like, right, what do you want it to be?
Mm.
Well, I want to be the best dad. I want to be better than the dad that I had. Right. So what if that's your core purpose in life? I hadn't even thought about that.
Mm.
Actually, without any meaning, there's choice. And so through that process, he got an intention, set himself an intention. So that's the second part. The third part is to what you say here is discipline. And I realise I've just, it's aid, actually. It spells aid. It's interesting. Awareness, intention, your sense of purpose, and then discipline. It's repeated practice.
Mm.
We are allowing ourselves to build unhelpful addictions and unhelpful neural pathways by allowing ourselves to be addicted to these screens, to ChatGPT, to finding the answers easily and smoothly, and on avoiding the reality of our lives. Life is difficult. Life is challenging.
One of the best metaphors I heard about the importance of human struggle is around going to the gym, right? So you don't go to the gym so that everyone looks at you and thinks that person has a great body. You go to the gym so everyone looks at you and thinks that's the kind of person who worked really hard for that body, right? So it's really about, and actually I think that there's a lot of this conversation that applies to the AI conversation as well, is that if you do the act of writing, which is what I do, and you put that, you outsource that to ChatGPT and you end up with something and you hand it over to a client, what you lose is not whatever the client got, because probably it's fine, you know? What you lose is that part of writing, the creation, those moments of frustration and going back and deleting and rewriting and things like that. All of that is incredibly enriching and rewarding in its own right. So everyone talks about replacing the output, but actually what happens when we replace the work, you know, the actual work? And I think that is one of the biggest questions we need to answer when it comes to AI in the future.
I think that's brilliant. And it's exactly the question I asked ChatGPT yesterday, as one of the platforms, because
the
I said,
irony.
Well, could AI be not the Terminator, the thing that turns on us? Could AI be the thing that means that human beings lose the muscle of transformational thinking? And ChatGPT's response was very interesting. It said, I do not create novel thinking.
Hmm.
I just create a rearrangement of the current thinking in a way that may seem novel. human beings are consciousness, have consciousness, and human beings are capable of breakthrough. And that breakthrough is the shift in consciousness on the planet that we actually need in order to solve the big problems that we have. AI can be an assistant in all of that, but the struggle is an important part of it. And I think that goes back to the workplace stuff, which is my job is to help leaders and organizations navigate some of the most complex challenges. In doing that, the results are sometimes therapeutic. Mm. The results are sometimes because they have to look at, they can't just look at the external world and deny themselves. They have to look at themselves. The work starts with me because I create the environment in which all the people I'm leading exist in. And if I don't create an environment that's helpful and safe for they're comfortable with being uncomfortable, they can't produce the outputs that are results, if that makes any sense. So I think it all links together.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think about one of the discussions we were having this morning with another guest around conformity and how at the end of the day, we all naturally conform. I mean, this question that we had almost inadvertently asked around work being weird now, every guest we bring on is like, work has always been weird. Why do we work 9 to 5, 5 days a week? Who decided that? It was a post-industrial revolution kind of construct that we all still stick to today for inexplicable reasons. And yet we continue to conform to existing structures. And I guess my question is, how do we use some of these therapeutic techniques to unpick some of those structures and systems that we continue to adhere to, regardless of whether or not they're serving us?
Yeah, I mean, cognitive behavioral therapy, let's take that as a basis of a lot. So a lot of the work I do is based on, is based on neuroscience, psychology, and different parts of psychology, psychotherapy, and also cognitive behavioral therapy. The work I was talking about earlier, when you're starting to challenge what your thinking is and whether it's true, false, or maybe, that's part of cognitive behavioral therapy. And in that cognitive behavioral therapy process, there's often an experiment that you get people to go and do. Mm. And that experiment creates breakthrough thinking. And I remember, you know, a dear friend of mine, ours, Claire, right? She tells me this brilliant, she's one of the top clinical, she will hate me for saying this, but she is one of the top clinical psychologists.
We were trying to get her on the pod, so hopefully this will
inspire. She's so humble. And she's incredible. And she told me this story about this person who was, you know, scared of germs. And so she wheeled her wheelchair down the corridor, dropped her apple in the toilet and ate it. And this person was horrified. Right? I was like, absolutely horrified. And she was like, I didn't, do you see? And a week later, she turns up. I'm not dead. She used herself as an experiment to show I didn't die. And then for the patient, it's like, well, what is the smallest experiment that you could go do that would go and start to prove that your thinking may be false or your assessments? We spend a lot of our life believing that we are asserting ourselves, that we are speaking facts when actually we are speaking assessments. An assessment is an assumption. It's a belief. Mm. The belief that we have to work 5 day weeks, blown away by Microsoft research. You know, I work with them. Mm. You know, they did a whole bunch of research out in the East and they started a 4 day week. And guess what? There was no performance drop whatsoever at all on a 4 day week. And the same amount of work got done. Well, I've worked in organizations where we did 45-minute meetings, not hour-long meetings. Guess what? Everything got done in those 45 minutes that needed to get done. We work in a set of assumptions that are just, you know, they're crazy and ridiculous at some level.
Hmm. So what are some examples from the work that you do day to day where you've really seen the power of some of these therapeutic practices brought into the work environment?
Yeah, I mean, working with an organization who was about to be closed down, shut down, because of the acts it had partaken in, unconsciously doing really bad, unethical things in the world that are well documented. You know, for example, one organization I work for, HSBC, laundered $880 million worth of drug cartel money. You know, there was a lot of media at the time they hired and drove the vehicles across the boundaries. And people, why did they do that? Well, guess what? The people in Mexico had images of their children held up in front of them and guns, his fingers held up. And so no wonder they changed the shapes of branches to import money and, you know, all of that kind of good stuff. But then it's the layers of thinking that, you know, people couldn't escalate the issue because they were scared. Mm. And people in organizational life, we found after 6 years worth of research in that organization. You know, we found one thing to be true. Good people will do very bad things or stupid things in good conscience to stay safe in their organizational system. You said we follow the rules, we ultimately conform. We conform to do what? What's the sub-purpose of that? Survival.
Yeah.
So, you know, 50,000 years ago, if we weren't part of the group, we'd die. We are interdependent species, and we've spent our life fearing dependence, becoming independent, but not really realizing we're interdependent, right? Mm. And that's the thing that gets missed all the time. And in that independence, that fear of, if I say something, my leader will think badly of me or they'll fire me, actually creates the environment where we could be all fired.
Mm.
And so when I've looked at those black swan events, and I've been in many organizations that have done some pretty challenging and what you would say awful things, people do it in good conscience. And so how does this work work? Well, it challenges your thinking. It asks you, what assumptions are you making in the moments when you're under pressure? And actually, if I question those assumptions, what am I believing? Am I believing some form of truth, or am I operating out of fear?
Mm.
And we're looking at, how often do we operate out of fear? And what happens neurobiologically when we're in fear? Creativity reduces. Our cognitive capacity reduces. Mm-hmm. Our collaboration disappears. And so actually, how do we help challenge our assumptions and shift our minds to the creative mind, the more resourceful mind? Because that's the incredible thing about human beings.
Yeah.
We have this capacity to be purposeful and creative.
Yeah, I mean, that is the argument that Dan and I keep having when we have these conversations with people about AI. We bring on these people who are incredible guests who tell us that, you know, the worst case scenario for AI and the fact that there's going to be Armageddon, effectively, I think is the word that a guest we had whose just episode came out this week had said. And it makes me think every time that this is the time for us to double down on our humanity.
Yeah.
And I guess, what do you see happening? I know I'm not asking you to predict the future, but as AI takes hold in organizations, what can people do? What can the human side, what can leadership do? What can the people who are looking out for the future of the human side of an organization do now to ensure that the humans are the best operating system working for humans as possible?
Well, this goes back to my UI plus AI argument. Universal intelligence is your operating system. So how do we keep that healthy, and what's the value in it? Well, the first thing, it's problematic, the statement you made in the first place is, as AI takes hold. AI is not taking hold, right? We're engineering it. And if it continues to be about money, and actually, if we think about it, all of the models are based on, you know, one thought or one theory. There's ultimately one thing that sits at the heart of it. And I'm going to be a bit challenging here, but the heart of the capitalist system is making money.
Mm-hmm.
And AI is being used to optimize making money. The problem in that system I see that's in there is, I remember this thing was that someone said, I think it was you said to me, like in 10 years or 5 years time, 50% of the roles that all school leavers are going to go, you know, they don't exist, won't exist anymore.
Yeah.
50% of roles. I'm like, okay, let's just take a basic theory of economy. Economy is about the sentiment that how confident we feel in our own system and the speed at which money moves around it. If 50% of our school leavers and our university leavers are not going into work, then there is no money. Then the system of the powerful who are optimizing making money collapses. it can't be that way. The human beings will adapt. So I sit here and say, I can't predict the future, but I don't predict the absolute anarchy and gloomy outcomes others do. I see massive opportunity. I see hope, because I believe that human beings at their core are good. The challenge is that many leaders who get into the positions they get into happen to be those who can tolerate a world of loneliness, can tolerate the world of separation. And therefore, I'm not saying that all leaders, you know, many leaders are sociopathic or psychopathic, but I'm saying that many can make harder decisions that others don't. And many are driven by achievement-orientated outcomes. I need to prove myself to the world. So there could be some damage done with it. But I just think we'll adapt. There'll be a change. Will there be a collapse? Probably.
Mm.
Will there be bloodshed because of it? I don't know any time in human history when a massive transformation hasn't caused bloodshed. So, you know, but will we make it through the other side? Likely. We always did.
I think the challenge is, to go back to your HSBC example, is that we as individuals have agency and we are ultimately good if we make that assumption from at the core. But it's when we're in a large system where we don't necessarily, we're just working to stay safe. Does the ultimate system of the human race become the next HSBC? But with,
maybe,
you know,
maybe it does. And I guess that's what my job is about, is helping waking. You know, I watched The Matrix again the other day. It strikes me as that some of our roles in the world is, and your podcast is about waking people up to other possibilities. It's not manipulating people into thinking a certain way. It's getting them to challenge and question what they see as true. That's my job in the world, is when you say, you tell me what you see as true, is that really true? Is that the truth? Or is there something else? And getting people to use that agency and to get curious, I think is going to be critical as we move forward. And I, whilst I have hope, I don't deny the fact that there will be, we're awfully stupid in groups. Another thing Claire, I'm going to hate to quote her twice because she'll kill me again, but she said to me once, Simon, the thing about culture, because I work with culture at scale, is that individuals are very rarely insane, except we see them on our news articles all the time, right? We publicise these, but actually, statistically, they're very rare, insane human beings. Groups of people are regularly, commonly insane. We do insane things in groups. When I look at things, take the PPI scandal in the UK, because I knew about it, speaking to other banking colleagues at the time, people in certain institutions were signing documents on behalf of customers to sign them up to insurance when they weren't in the room. That happened. And these are people who, in their home lives, have good conscience and are good parents, good mothers, good fathers, and in that system felt the pressure that if they didn't do that, then their branch might collapse, then they might lose their job, and therefore they can't put money on the table. Human beings under threat do stupid things. So, yeah, how do we create the environments where human beings can start to really question what they're thinking and feeling?
Well, so let's break that down a little bit then. If we start with the individual then, how do I become an individual who would make the right choices in that scenario?
I mean, if you look at Daniel Kahneman and his work, he'll probably say, you're buggered.
Right.
You're naturally biased. But I think this process of having a discipline of curiosity in the world, to practice, and I mean, there are so many things linked to it. We've talked about it before, which is eating well, right? How do you keep your brain and organic system healthy? Because we know that when we've slept well, we've eaten well, we've got a supportive network of people around us, we make better decisions. We know that. That's, you know, so there's a health thing here. Then there's the second part, which goes back to a bit of my thought earlier, which is awareness of who you are and what situations, what are my triggers? What are the things that set me off into limiting beliefs and get in the way of me acting in a way that is not my intention? If we take a value, name a value of yours.
Oh, gosh, I did this work. What was... Oh, no, on the spot now.
Yeah, oh, no, sorry, I put you on the
spot.
No,
it's all right, because I'm thinking, because I did a whole values piece of the day with a coach, right? As I need to figure out my values. And she was like, well, just say them. And I reeled a load off and she laid them back to me. She was like, do you realise how much they're all clashing? She's like, you can't have all of those.
You can say integrity, because that's what every business says.
Don't say integrity.
Not integrity. But it was so interesting. She's like, don't you realise how much they're all clashing? And I was like...
Yeah, your values rub. They do.
Yeah. They were all conflicts. There's no way you can have all of those underpinning.
Well, it's not true, actually. I'm going to conflict against your coach. You can have them, but it's a hard life to live.
I think that was it. That's not sustainable for what it is that you want to achieve and create. And what is that right now? And she's like, they don't all have to be it forever. You say them now, that's it forever. Yeah. What's the most important thing in the next 12 months to you now?
That's a great question.
And it was a really good way to replay it. Like, don't think whatever you're saying right now is going to be it. Strip it back and do
it. What was one of those values? That's really important to you, something that's important to you in work and life.
I can answer it for her.
Yeah.
I think like human connection, relationships are a value for you. You value the sort of strength of your relationships.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so relationships are really important to you. How is that your superpower? Just tell me a little bit about how that's your superpower. What's it brought you and what the gifts that it's given you?
Do you know, I'm going back, my mind went straight to school then, and I was school sports captain. I was captain of many teams.
Wow.
And throughout my career, I've never been the strongest academically, but I've been good with people and I've been a good facilitator and bringing people together. And that feels like almost a strength I didn't even know was a strength.
Yes.
So I'm not the smartest in the room, definitely not. But I think human connection and bringing people together is something that I've realised over time is something that I love.
Mm.
Yeah.
You don't believe you're the smartest person, though. You just named that.
Oh, no, I'm definitely not.
Yeah, but you are on EQ. You're classifying yourself on IQ.
Oh, I am.
Right.
So the emotional intelligence, I can feel when something's off in a room, 100%.
Yeah.
But the downside of that is I can be quite sensitive and take things to really to heart.
Yes.
But I'll also take on people's emotions in the room and carry it as well.
For a burden carrier.
Quite exhaustive.
Yeah. You're doing my work for me.
Yeah.
This is great. But this is really, really fascinating. You notice how you gave yourself, I'm not an intelligent person. But actually, there are three forms of intelligence for me, maybe many more, but is IQ. You know, your knowledge, your ability to, you know, your cognitive capacity. Then there's the EQ, your emotional intelligence. And then there's SQ, which is systemic or spiritual intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're strengthening those two less recognized in society ones. I have to have, if I don't have relationships then, if I can't bring people together then, finish that sentence.
If I can't bring people together.
Yeah, if I can't bring this group of people together, you said you're passionate about bringing people together, creating connection. If I can't create connection, then what are you?
Don't know. I don't use the word failure, but that's not...
Failure,
that's not failure. Is that failure?
Well, it might not be. Well, you're getting in the way of your own mind, you're questioning, but your immediate thought is failure.
It was, yeah. Right. I was like, oh, shit, that's a failure.
Right, so...
Sorry, I swore on the pod and on video.
Yeah.
It's happened before.
I'm sure it'll happen again. So notice this, and this is what's interesting, is when your value is playing out perfectly, people will experience you as a connector.
Mm.
When your value is being overplayed and you're seeing disconnection in an environment where you're trying to make connection, what might people see as a behaviour of yours?
Yeah, almost anxiousness, probably.
People-pleasing.
People-pleasing.
People-pleasing and anxiety. Yeah. And the likelihood that they're going to make authentic connection when you are desperate and anxious for them to connect and trying to please them is what?
Mm.
High or low?
Sorry, what's the relay the question again?
So the question again is when you're desperate for people to make strong connections in a room and they are not, and you're people pleasing, showing desperation and showing anxiety, the likelihood that they're going to connect is what?
Oh, low.
Low.
Yeah.
So here's the funny thing about our values is that we have these value systems that when they're overplayed and we're under pressure and we're in an environment where we're triggered into the thing that we feel we have to do, we end up being less than who we are.
And not by far from the versions of ourselves that we want to be. I was going to say the best version of ourselves. That's not it. It's just the version of ourselves that we want to be.
Well, and actually, sometimes we have a high bar. We want to be the best version of ourselves. And actually, I spend my life trying to help leaders just become who they are.
Yeah.
Be the youest you that ever you'd.
I struggle in those moments of like, what are your values? Who are you? And I think there's so...
You do.
It's all that. And you go, oh my God, what? Like, yeah, it's... It's really like...
I saw the fog come in.
Yeah. The fog, because it's so tricky when there's so much and like parent, work, all of the tapestry careers, portfolio careers, so many different things that are spinning to just figure things out and life being so hectic and busy and so many lanes and all of those things. When you then actually go back, who am I? Don't know.
Yeah. And I think the reason why this is so important, it's an example of why this is important in the room, is that what you've just said is what most people do is instead of having that difficult struggle and working that out because it's complex, it's emotional, and I have to unpack things, we avoid it by just getting on with life.
Yes, yeah.
And then what happens is you probably end up on my books, you know, years later, because 90% of the people I work with these days are women who have frankly lost their identity by giving their identity either to work or to being a mother. And that's not a bad thing.
Mm.
But somewhere along the way, they didn't stop and think, who am I and what do I want? Because everyone else's needs, others' orientation, I need to make you connect and lose connection with yourself.
Mm.
And in that moment, we start making unhelpful decisions because we're doing things to try and fix that value, and that your experience will have been related to a life experience before or a life experience of your parents, right? And when we get into those modes and triggered, that's when we start not living who we are. And then collectively, the whole room gets multiple triggers.
Does that make sense? Oh, yeah.
So what advice would you give to organizations who are trying to navigate the future in this kind of unknown context that we're in? What should they be doing with their people?
Yeah, helping create adaptive leaders who can think adaptively and be adaptive, who can work with their own inner state and be able to, it's not manage their inner state, but be able to be in, you know, to find breakthrough, to be able to step into the discomfort of not knowing. Most of the leaders in organizations I meet are desperate to achieve results. And that's the number one thing, and be perfection and or be in control. And all of those things are the things that blight our capacity to make breakthroughs to the next level of organizational life and the survival. The very thing we do when we move into protection, as your example, you know, is a perfect example, is that when we move to protection, we make less likely the outcome we want to create. Mm-hmm. So my advice to organizations is start to work with the inner game of people. And yet be very careful, going back to our earlier conversation, or full of care about the balance between people's choice of what they're willing to discuss and bring and the balance between what might have healing outcomes for an organization. Because there's something I haven't named here is that organizations go through trauma, losing 10,000 staff. Two organizations I know in the last 6 months have made redundant that number of people, 10,000 people. That's an organizational death that happened, and we don't give any support to the people who survive. And so how do you help people cope with that? Start naming it. Start instead of just focusing on the future goal, start to acknowledge the story and the path and the history that got here, and start to acknowledge the challenges that are real challenges that stand in our way, and be more human as a leader. Yeah, be more human as a leader.
Great. Perfectly well wrapped up at the end. Thank you, Simon. As before, it's been great having you here. Hopefully you'll come back again. I've just decided you're officially going to be a regular guest.
Well, I was just about to say, we've got the episode title of the next one, How Do You Be More Human as a Leader?
Yes, thank you.
Even before you come back.
I love hanging out with you guys. I learn by thinking, so yeah, it's great.
Fantastic. Tell us again how people can get in touch with you.
Yeah, via LinkedIn. I'm there, via our website, purposefulchange.com. I'm Instagram, I think we're on as well. There's a book that's coming. It's because I'm not using AI, it's taking a long time. It's a freaking struggle.
Even if feather and ink.
I'm not doing that. I am using my fingers. But because I don't read, I don't know how a book's structured. So I'm learning to structure a book by writing the bugger. And it's painful. But it's great.
It's all about the struggle.
It is about the struggle. I have to live my own work.
The fulfillment on the other side will be...
Oh, thank you for coaching me.
You are welcome.
Thanks so much.
It's great. Thank you.